Consolidation was happening so rapidly and ownership changes were happening so rapidly that in the span of six paychecks, I actually worked in the same job for five different companies.
This week on the program, documenting the FCC's legacy of failure with Dr. Christopher Terry.
NPR leaves the Mike Coalition. Why is this important? What's the Mike Coalition?
And we have a listener commentary to share about HD Radio.
This is the Radio Survivor program. It is a show about radio and the people who care about it. I'm your host, Eric Klein.
And I'm Paul Riesmandel, your other host. And, you know, it was kind of a nice week last week. We got featured on iTunes, in the iTunes store, under their new and noteworthy section for news and politics.
That was nice.
Yes.
It's nice for us.
It's nice for us.
Is it nice for iTunes?
I hope so. You know, we've mentioned it before that, you know, iTunes is still the 900-pound gorilla in podcasting. It's where most people go to find new podcasts.
Right.
And it's connected directly to everybody's iPhone who has an iPhone when they click podcasts and then go and search for things. And so if people went looking for news and politics, they were more likely to find us. And we do really appreciate that. We did nothing except create the show. So
something went right.
Something went right. And so we definitely want to say thanks to iTunes. And that's already early in the show. We'll say, hey, if you're enjoying the show, go there and leave us a review and click a star.
So, Paul, our first story on the show is NPR has left the Mike Coalition. I've never heard of the Mike Coalition. I'm assuming most people haven't. Who are they?
You know, it's hard to know. You know them by their membership to some extent. So there are big companies involved, and NPR was one of them. Amazon was one of them.
Okay.
Amazon has dropped out, and now NPR has dropped out just last week. It's a lobbying group. We know that much. And it has been characterized as anti-artists by some musicians and musicians group. For instance, the Music First executive director, Ted Kalo, which is a musicians group, mm-hmm. He says, quote, "The supposedly new Mike Coalition looks like little more than some of the world's biggest and wealthiest corporations and the trade associations they fund, hiding behind a new website and a gauzy mission statement as they continue their campaign to deny fair pay to working musicians." And NPR in particular came in for criticism for being a member from musician David Lowry. He's from the bands Camper Van Beethoven and Cracker. And he was said that this is something that NPR should not be a part of. But so I wanted to learn more what is going on.
Right.
So I talk with Kevin Erickson. He is the communications and outreach manager for the Future of Music Coalition, which is another group that advocates on behalf of musicians and artists. I started by asking Kevin, what is the Mike Coalition?
Well, we don't actually know a whole lot about what the Mike Coalition's specific policy goals are. It's a coalition of different kinds of industry groups that license music in their day-to-day use, ranging from broadcasters, including the National Association of Broadcasters, to technology companies, Google and Pandora. In addition, there's restaurant trade organizations, a bunch of different groups that had come together to be sort of a unified voice around issues of music licensing. And one of those groups that had joined that coalition was NPR. We don't know to what degree that coalition was actually involved in lobbying on the Fair Play, Fair Pay Act, which is currently under consideration by Congress. But that was sort of the core criticism that had been leveled at NPR, that they were potentially joining this group that was trying to stop artists from getting paid for when they're played on AM/FM radio and keeping the sort of status quo policy that we've been stuck with in the United States, where artists currently don't get paid, which sets the United States apart in the rest of the developed world.
So they don't get paid. Tell me a little bit what they don't get paid for. Unpack that a little bit.
One way to think about it is that, like, when you hear the Counting Crows recording of the song Big Yellow Taxi on FM radio in the United States, Joni Mitchell, the composer of Big Yellow Taxi, gets compensated for that. But the Counting Crows, the performers, don't get anything for that performance. However, if you hear the same song played on Sirius XM or on a webcast or on Pandora and a cable music station, even on that same terrestrial radio station's webcast, both Joni Mitchell and the Counting Crows are compensated. There's this weird loophole in U.S. copyright law that has meant that terrestrial broadcasters are exempt from paying for a public performance right for sound recordings, for performances. And what that ends up meaning is that while songwriters and publishers get paid, performers and sound recording copyright owners, often record labels, but sometimes the artists themselves, don't get paid.
And this Fair Play, Fair Pay Act that you mentioned, is that bill intended to change the situation, to require now broadcast stations to pay these performance royalties?
Yes. So there's been a number of attempts to fix this loophole over the years. And the Fair Play, Fair Pay Act, which was introduced in April by Gerald Nadler and Marsha Blackburn, is the most recent. And fixing the performance right loophole is sort of the centerpiece of that legislation. It would amend the Copyright Act to eliminate the distinctions between different kinds of radio with regard to who they pay. So regardless of whether you hear a song on FM radio or Pandora or satellite radio or cable radio, any of those non-interactive services, both the performer and the songwriter would get paid.
And this is something which the broadcast industry at large is opposing?
That's correct. So the principal opponent to fixing this loophole over the years has been the National Association of Broadcasters. Because they're so large and so powerful, and they've got stations in every congressional district, they've been able to hold the line back despite the music community really pushing to change this since, I think Frank Sinatra was working on this issue back in the day. I think this new conversation around the Fair Play, Fair Pay Act is going to be different, though. There's some new elements and some new moving pieces, which gives me a lot of hope that this is going to be the moment that we're actually able to fix this and close that loophole once and for all. The most central difference, at least as it concerns community radio stations and college stations and LPFM stations, the first thing people in the community radio universe want to know is, how will this impact us? And the answer is, don't worry, because the bill sets the annual fee for all of those stations at $100 a year, and that works out to about 27 cents a day. So one of the things that has happened every time we've had this legislative debate before is the National Association of Broadcasters uses this crazy, horrifying rhetoric about these new fees and taxes that are going to cripple community radio and cripple college radio and local radio. And the carve out in this new version of the bill is just much more generous than has ever been proposed before. It's just $100 a year. 27 cents a day isn't going to bankrupt any station. It's totally manageable. And I think that's good. And I think that artists understand that because they understand how important these kinds of stations can be for musicians and often affording them a platform, especially for emerging, smaller, independent, developing artists who might not have access to commercial radio. They understand that they provide this really important, unique role, and they deserve a lower tier price.
And my understanding is that one of the big justifications for broadcast being exempt from this performance rights royalty payment has been the promotional role that radio plays, and that radio gives back to the artist by playing their music, exposing more people to it, driving sales, driving concert tickets, and raising them up. So given that trade-off, why now are artists seeking to get this other payment?
First of all, you want to have consistency across the board. When you look at other kinds of radio that provide us the same kind of promotional support, like Pandora and Sirius XM and cable radio, all pay both the songwriter and the performer. Similarly, has the same kind of promotional values. You recognize that there, yes, radio promotion is good for artists, but you still have to compensate artists for something. I think it's worth understanding that in a way, everything that an artist does in 2015 promotes everything else that they do. You know, the tour promotes the record and the record promotes the tour. The t-shirt promotes the band, but you still have to pay for the t-shirt, you know? That something has a promotional value to it doesn't mean that it's free. And finally, it's worth understanding how the promotional value accrues in different ways to different audiences. So if I'm a backing vocalist or the person playing trumpet on a Mark Ronson song or something like that, I'm not getting any promotional value out of the airplay for that song because the DJ is not reading those people's names. They're contributing to the value of the song. It's important to find a way to compensate them for the value that they're creating there. So it's they use a 55-45-5 split. So 50% goes to the sound recording owner, which is sometimes a record label, and then sometimes the artist, him or herself. 45% goes to the featured artist, and then the remaining 5% goes into union-administered funds for backing vocalists and session musicians. And by the way, you don't need to be a union member to collect out of that pool if you're a backing musician. Crucially, it's direct payment. It can't be like tied up in label accounting or anything like that. It goes straight into the artist's pocket. So, you know, if there's any concern about like this bill makes our station pay this money and we're not sure that that money's actually going to make it into the pockets of the artist, it's a system that you can have confidence about and that it really does end up benefiting artists directly.
You know, given that it's not very much money from each station, I mean, is it really enough for all these independent artists in particular? You know, at that point, you know, you start to wonder, well, why impose a fee at all?
Right. And, you know, it is true that commercial radio, where most of the money is going to be generated, is kind of locked down by the same handful of big corporations. And there's not a lot of diversity there. One of the most important things, though, that this bill would do would be to unlock royalties that are collected overseas because of this thing called reciprocity rules. So right now, because the United States doesn't pay international artists when their music is played here, when American artists are played overseas, they don't get paid for that.
Oh, wow, really?
So everybody else gets paid because we don't pay Adele in the United States if Sufjan Stevens gets played in the UK, he doesn't get paid.
Huh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's crazy. What that means is that the United States musicians are essentially being forced to export their music for free. I can't think of any other product that's true for. But it's the good news is that's easy to fix. So as soon as the United States creates a system where performers get compensated, the money from all the overseas airplay, all these countries where playlists are more diverse. And, you know, when you talk to independent labels, they'll tell you this. They'll say, we're not getting any airplay except for college and community and public radio at home, but we are getting actual airplay in Germany and Belgium for some reason. So they'll be able to collect those royalties for the first time.
And that was Kevin Erickson of the Future of Music Coalition talking about the Fair Play, Fair Pay Act. It's currently in committee in the House of Representatives.
And it's, what is this? This is basically a generations-long battle over how artists get paid when their songs get played on the radio.
Correct.
Inched forward or backwards, depending on your point of view, as the NPR has left one of the coalitions fighting this Fair Play for Fair Pay
Act. Yes, that's what
this
it looks like.
Unfortunately named alliterative mess.
Looks great on paper. It's terrible to have to say.
I don't want to say it out loud ever again.
And I think this is important because one of the things that I keep coming back to on Rail Survivor here on the podcast, on the website, is how independent artists, musicians, and independent stations, community stations, college stations, public stations, are really in it together.
Right.
It's really a certain type of symbiosis, I think. And I think sometimes when stations hear, oh my gosh, but they want to charge us some additional money because they already are paying money to ASCAP and BMI for songwriting royalties. And then if they have a web stream, they're already paying these fees as well to Sound Exchange. They hear, oh my gosh, one more fee. You know, we love the artists, but this is getting to be too much.
The music industry is being greedy. Yet again.
That's exactly what you hear. So I think it's important to try and understand it and get some perspective. And I think that Kevin did a good job of laying it out and told me a few things that I didn't understand or know before, specifically the reciprocity issue.
Right.
I didn't realize that even though the royalties are charged overseas, that because we don't charge them here in the U.S., that U.S.-based artists don't get that money.
Yeah.
And then it would unlock that money. That was something I did not realize and kind of, you know, really – I think shined a new light on this whole issue. And it's something we're going to keep discussing, and we'll see where this bill goes in Congress when it gets marked up finally in committee and has an opportunity to go to the floor for a vote. We'll definitely let you know and continue to cover it here.
And how it'll impact community radio.
And we'll try to make sure that you know how it'll impact community stations, public stations, webcasters.
Right.
All of the above. Everyone who is trying to fight the good fight on the airways will keep you up to date. And if you have an opinion about this, if you've got something to say, maybe you have to add something to what Kevin had to say, or maybe you're a station, you're still concerned about the potential of having to pay these royalties, drop us an email, send them to podcast@radiosurvivor.com.
Up next on the program is College Radio Watch with Jennifer Waits.
Hello, Jennifer. Are you ready to tell us about what's going on in college radio this week?
I'm excited to tell you.
The story we're going to talk about this week is about some pretty massive changes at one college station.
Yeah, at KCPR, which is at Cal Poly, San Luis Obispo, which is in California, kind of in the middle of the state. And last month, well, in June, actually, word just came out that they're making some pretty big changes to the station. And the main changes are that non-students will no longer be allowed to be on the air at KCPR. And additionally, there will be no more graveyard shifts. So the station will be running automated programming from midnight until 5 a.m. And then finally, all DJs now have to take a class and be registered. The station is under the auspices of the journalism department.
These changes sound like something big must have happened, like a big problem.
Well, you know, a variety of things happened. There was a really extensive piece in the New Times, San Luis Obispo, and it outlines kind of the history of what possibly led to these changes. So there was an incident last year where some DJs did some antics that got some bad press for the station, and that probably prompted changes to happen maybe sooner than originally planned. But leading up to that, there was a new person in charge of the journalism department, and under her purview, they were starting to look at all of the student media outlets, and KCPR was kind of next on the list. So I think having an incident happen at the station made them decide to take a closer look at the station maybe sooner than they'd planned.
What was that incident?
So there were some DJs who, I don't even think it happened on the air, actually, but it was kind of an unauthorized fundraiser during a late night talk show that had sort of, I think it was a sex talk show, actually. And I think they were inviting people to send in kind of naughty Snapchats. Word of it leaked out, and then some articles were written about it. And then, understandably, the school was not pleased to hear about this, and I think they felt like maybe the station had kind of gone rogue and didn't have enough supervision. So following that, they had kind of a task force examine what was going on at the station and talk about plans for the future. So a group of people on the task force, which included students and people from the radio industry and faculty members, so a wide variety of people on the task force, took a look at the station and then offered up their recommendations for how it should proceed. And probably largely, you know, just to have more oversight to prevent things like that from happening again.
How many non-students have been active at the station up to now?
So recently, the non-student members were just told that they would no longer be able to have shows, permanent shows, and it was around a dozen non-student DJs in recent years. And that included even faculty members who were DJing at the station. And some of them had been on the air for decades. So one had been on the air since he was a student 28 years ago. So for 28 years, and then a faculty member had been on the air for 18 years.
What is the reasoning for getting rid of the non-student hosts?
You know, it's they want to return to the roots as it being a student organization. And that's why they're requiring everyone to take a class. So it looks like it's going to be 100% student operation. And it sounds like the non-students, there will still be opportunities for them to serve as mentors for the student DJs. So they may not disappear completely. But as far as, you know, if they're trying to have increasing oversight over the station, I'm not sure that eliminating community members necessarily accomplishes that goal.
Why do you say that?
Because I don't think necessarily having community members around creates a rogue atmosphere. You know, like I mentioned, some of these community DJs have been at the station for decades. Well, obviously that provides this sense of continuity, and having people who have this historical knowledge of the station, that can be a really good thing. You know, those people probably know more details about FCC rules and can serve as mentors. So I think it's helpful to have a mix of community and student DJs around. But, you know, it's hard to know exactly what the culture was. I don't know if there was something specific about these community members that was creating problems at KCPR.
Is it common to have community members as DJs alongside students at college stations, or is it more of a rarity?
I think it's pretty common. Like I mentioned, some of the community members were actually students there at one time. Pretty much every college radio station that I've been a DJ at, that's been the case, where you have some alums who stick around. And then often you have people from the community or faculty members who are also interested in getting on air. But, you know, there are stations who also have rules about it being 100% students, or some that even have other criteria, like it can be, the station can have no more than 40% community members. So that's a way to stay true to, if you have a student, kind of a student-oriented mission, if you have something codified like that, then it can help you stick to that mission.
For college radio as a whole, is this something that's part of a larger trend that might be a threat, or is this some kind of outlier?
I mean, in this case, it's kind of too soon to tell. I've seen examples of college radio stations that have done this where they've eliminated non-student DJs, and that has been kind of the first step to a lot of changes that led to the loss of an FM license, you know, which is what happened at WRVU at Vanderbilt. One of the first things they did was eliminate non-student DJs. So it's hard to tell. It doesn't mean that's what's going to happen at KCPR. I'm not saying that.
And KCPR is owned by the university, correct?
Yeah.
And if I recall correctly, WRVU was owned by a separate nonprofit, not Vanderbilt University.
Yeah, it was owned by a separate nonprofit that was meant to make sure that, initially, meant to make sure that student media was protected and not interfered with by the university. So yeah, it's hard to say. We've seen other examples where things have been returned to the students after there's been like a large community takeover and things are going amazingly well.
Is there a station that comes to mind?
Yeah, I'm thinking of WLUW in Chicago, and that was at Loyola University there. And they had an outside group kind of running the station for a while, and then they ended that relationship following the aftermath of that. Community members left and started up their own online station, and then students took more control over the station at Loyola. And that seems to be going just fine, and the school is very supportive of the radio station.
Well, Jennifer, I hope you'll keep us up to date with what happens at KCPR. I'm sure you'll be covering it in your weekly college radio feature every Friday at radiosurvivor.com.
Yes.
Well, thanks a lot for that update, and I look forward to catching up with you next week.
Sure, thanks.
So that was kind of a sad story all around. If you love college radio, well, or maybe it's just me, but the worst part of that story for me is that the overnight college radio was being shut down, which is sort of, you know, it's if you don't like it, don't listen. But I have very fond memories of the sorts of things you can hear on those kinds of radio stations when everyone else is asleep.
Yes, I had many overnight shifts myself, and I enjoyed it. And yes, I mean, there's a tendency when you're 18 years old, maybe to be a bit sophomoric and push the boundaries, even if what you're doing really isn't illegal or against FCC rules. But it feels like also that's a time that permits a little bit of accidental transgression, with one of the great things being that radio is still ephemeral.
Right. And I mean, that's also I have experience with as a fan of stations when that's when they really would program a lot more experimental music.
Right. Yeah. Let's just hope that maybe once they right the ship over there at San Luis Obispo, that they can put people back on the air live in the overnights. Coming up, we have some listener commentary that we're going to share with you about HD radio. And of course, we love to get your comments. We've mentioned before that we've been getting lots of great comments and critical comments and people taking us to task on things or giving us corrections. And we'd love to share your thoughts, not just about the show, but about radio, about any of the topics that we talk about. Send us an email, podcast@radiosurvivor.com. And if you've got something you'd like us to read, we'd do that. Even better, if we can find out a way for you to record your comments, we'd like to share your voice with our listeners.
If you have a smartphone, record yourself on a voice memo app and email it to us. It's so easy these days.
Super simple, and we'll help you if you need any help. Just drop us a line, podcast@radiosurvivor.com. And of course, Radio Survivor is at radiosurvivor.com. If you're finding this podcast, you've never seen the website, may I encourage you to go take a look every single day. Stories about radio that matters. We try to take a look at what makes our ability to create and receive great radio and what are some of the threats. And we like to celebrate the people who are making great radio and the great radio that is made. So go to radiosurvivor.com to see that. And I'd also like to ask you to consider supporting this website and this podcast. These are non-commercial endeavors. We're doing our best to survive as independent entities supported by listeners and readers like you. We're using Patreon as our fundraising platform, and that permits you to pledge a given amount every single month to become kind of a sustaining donor, which is something which is very popular now in community radio and in public radio. And you can start out at just $1 a month, $12 a year. And that provides us sustaining funds to keep going. And then if you can give a little more, $5 or $10 a month, then we also have rewards for you. Go to patreon.com/radiosurvivor and learn more about that. And as we keep doing the show, we're going to have some bonus segments, things we won't have time here for the show that we'd like to share with you, that we're going to share only really with our Patreon subscribers. And we'll tell you when that happens. But right now, you should go ahead and check it out and get ahead of the game. That's patreon.com/radiosurvivor.
Up next, we're going to commemorate an important but little-known milestone in recent media history. July 7 was the anniversary of a court decision in a David and Goliath-type battle between grassroots radio and the George W. Bush FCC, a decision that seemed to turn the tide on media consolidation in the U.S. The Prometheus Radio Project, a group that helps build community radio stations, beat the FCC in federal court and preserved what was left of the rules that prevent even more massive media monopolies from being formed. To explain the court case and why it matters, we spoke with Dr. Christopher Terry, who wrote an essay on the Prometheus versus FCC case for Radio Survivor's website. Dr. Terry teaches media law and policy in the Department of Journalism, Advertising, and Media Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, and has 15 years' experience as a producer in commercial radio.
The anniversary is a decision, a legal decision involving the Prometheus Radio Projects when they sued the FCC over the FCC's media ownerships decisions. It's actually the second case. The anniversary is actually the second decision, which came out in 2011. Well, in the first case, the FCC had acted with a bad procedure and had tried to implement an even more aggressive consolidation regime known as the Diversity Index. It was a fairly illogical system based on game theory that was designed to allow even more consolidation than the 1996 Telecommunications Act originally had allowed for. At the time, the chairman of the FCC was Michael Powell, who's now a cable lobbyist. But he was very interested in coming up with a new system of calculations. The Telecommunications Act has some pretty straightforward limits. 39% of the national television audience, how many broadcast television stations one company can own, and then the local-based limit on the number of radio stations that companies could own. But the FCC ran out the table on that level of consolidation very quickly. By 2005, it was all on the table. Essentially, every market that could have been consolidated was. So the FCC changed the rules a little bit and came up with a new way of calculating diversity and ownership, and that was the diversity index. And it essentially would have created an environment in which there would have been even less competitors and less owners than the Telecommunications Act would have provided for.
So this is a anniversary of the court challenge from the Prometheus Radio Project. What were they arguing?
They asked a very simple question of the FCC. How can you justify this? The problem, of course, was is that the FCC had not developed any level of rational evidence to show that their procedures on media ownership between 1996 and 2003 had had a positive effect. And when challenged by that in court, administrative agencies have to prove that their policies are working and meeting their objectives and can be supported by rational empirical evidence that supports that. And because the policy was having absolutely the opposite effects of its intent in terms of ownership diversity, in terms of the number of owners, the FCC was sort of left holding the bag. And in the 2003 case, the court remands almost the entire FCC decision back to the agency and says, go back and try again.
What was it that the FCC at that time was proposing? What was this diversity index and what was it measuring?
Well, it was based on an economic indicator of antitrust. And the math is more complicated than I could explain in 20 minutes. But essentially, the goal of the diversity index was to create an environment where there would be six competitors, not six equal competitors, but six competitors for the media marketplace in any media market. Now, that's a little bit deceptive because they would have considered independent websites as potentially one of those six competitors.
And a six-entity system means that if you have that many entities, then you have, the FCC at that time was arguing, you have a competitive market, that it's not overly consolidated and everything is A-OK.
Absolutely.
And so this rule then, the Third Circuit Court found that the FCC had not justified it and sent it back, said, you know, whatever math, whatever that you're using for this, it doesn't add up and we require some more work. And so the FCC took it back and then did what?
Well, that's where the story kind of gets interesting. You have a changeover in the commission's leadership. You have Michael Powell is replaced by Kevin Martin, another Bush appointee to the commission. And in early 2007, they release a new proposed media ownership policy design. This time, essentially trying to do away with the longstanding prohibition on newspaper broadcast cross-ownership. And associated with that comes out the FCC's new policy on minority ownership. Minority ownership includes racial and ethnic minorities, but also ownership of stations by women. As part of the debate over media ownership, there's some intent to get additional stations into the hands and control of minority groups. But the FCC's policy on that was thrown out of court in an entirely separate proceeding. But part of the remand from the 2003 decision in Prometheus encouraged the FCC to come up with a more logical policy that would put more stations in the hands of minorities and women. And the FCC folded what was essentially a separate proceeding into its media ownership proceeding and released that as part of the challenge. And that's what goes to the Third Circuit in the second Prometheus case. And in July of 2011, the Third Circuit sends it back to the FCC again and says, you still have not done the work that is necessary. Come up with something that shows that this policy is having the effect that we are asking you to generate, showing diversity in ownership and putting stations in the hands of women and minorities.
So, Christopher, this whole thing seems like a whole lot of legalistic twisting and turning. And in the end, why couldn't Michael Powell's FCC just come out and say that increasing stockholder value for large media companies is a good reason to change the rules, and that's why we're doing it? Why did they go down this whole path of media ownership and diversity?
The simple answer is they have to. Part of the rules allow for regulation under competition, but the FCC's delegation of powers also requires them to make a public interest assessment of the rules that they pass. And their basic policy, which is known as outlet diversity, it has as a stated goal the creation of diverse and antagonistic viewpoints at the local level. And they had to at least pay lip service to the idea that these changes were having a positive effect for the listeners, the audience, and couldn't just go ahead and say, we're doing this just for the economics. That's very clear that that's what they were doing, but they couldn't just come out and say that.
So they had to have this cover where they had to sort of create the smokescreen that they were somehow either preserving diversity in a market or increasing diversity by coming up with new indices and new ways of calculating that diversity, which apparently the Third Circuit Court saw right through. And that's why they kept tossing it back to the FCC.
But of course, the FCC hadn't done any sort of empirical analysis that demonstrated that it was having that effect. In fact, the number of formats had been drastically reduced. The diversity of playlists had been drastically reduced. And the FCC even had evidence that consolidation was having a negative effect on advertising rates, that it wasn't even generating some kind of economic benefit. Of course, the commission buried that evidence and lost the two studies it actually did produce, and then tried instead to put out two sets of economic data to sort of confuse people. But when that lost data appeared during Kevin Martin's Senate hearings, things got very interesting for the FCC because they had data that showed the policy was having the absolute opposite effect of its intent, and they had had that data in their hands since 2003.
So why are we talking about this right now? Why does this all matter?
Well, it matters for two reasons. Number one, the FCC has a legal requirement under the Telecommunications Act to review media ownership rules, come up with a new decision every 4 years. They launched the last proceeding in 2010, and we are now almost through 2015 without a decision there and very little movement in that that aspect. But also, we're about to see another range of consolidation occur. Prior to the 2016 elections, there's going to be a great momentum to buy up broadcast television stations to cash in on the advertising revenue generated by the political elections in 2016. And because media ownership policy has essentially been stalled in this country back to 2003, some really bad rules are still on the books.
And what are some of those bad rules that remain that you think ought to be reviewed or changed?
Well, I think the limits in the 1996 Telecommunications Act themselves are fairly irrational. It doesn't make sense to allow companies to have more than 45% of the market share. And the FCC was approving deals that essentially gave the top two competitors in a market 99.5% control of the media in that market. And it approved deals that did that back in 2004. And those rules are still the rules. It's very, very easy to transfer a station license through the act of consolidation these days. And with the 2016 political advertising bonanza, on the horizon, there's going to be some significant movement. And stations haven't been moving down the chain. They haven't been moving to smaller independent operators or minority groups. They've been continually being consolidated by larger groups. And unless the FCC acts, it's going to be really hard to stop that process before 2016.
Let's talk a little bit about why consolidation is bad. You know, it's something which, you know, we sometimes, those of us who work in community radio and in this end of things, we take it for granted why it's bad. But you actually, prior to becoming a university lecturer, you got a firsthand view, very up close view of the effects of consolidation. Tell us a little bit about what you saw.
Well, it's why I became very interested in the topic. I was very interested in community-based radio, local radio. I always thought that that was one of the really interesting things about radio as a medium, just the fact that it did allow such a local basis for the programming. And although I'm pretty much a political liberal, I was working in political talk radio at the time that consolidation really hit the market here in Milwaukee where I worked. And I saw the effects almost immediately. I always tell the story, and the consolidation was happening so rapidly and ownership changes were happening so rapidly that in the span of six paychecks, I actually worked in the same job for five different companies. But things that went away were the things that I thought made radio very powerful. We lost local programming. We lost doing local news. News operations were consolidated on a national basis. We lost equipment. We lost personnel. We lost, you know, the quantity of live programming we were producing was increasingly being produced by syndicated programming. And we lost the radio station that I worked for, still very powerful local station, but it lost some of its character. It lost some of its touch with the community. And it was hard to take as somebody who believes in the medium a lot.
And what were you doing? What was your job?
I was a sort of off-air producer. I did a lot of news talk and sports programming for Clear Channel. I started with Hearst. We went from Hearst to Capstar organization and then a Radio Star and then AM/FM and eventually to Clear Channel.
These are all the companies that owned the station. And that was what year?
That was 2000.
So 4 years after the Telecommunications Act, and probably a similar thing had already played out in some larger markets around the country, and by 2000, it began to hit Milwaukee. I'm sure when you are teaching your students there, right, they grew up with radio being the way we experience it now. You know, they are post-consolidation kids, for all intents and purposes. How do you impress upon them the changes? You know, how do you make that real to them? Or how do you explain it in a way that makes it vivid and palpable rather than them having to just sort of look at it and go, well, I mean, that's the way it is, it, you know, whatever.
Well, with my students, there's a really easy way to do it, to explain it to them. I talk about the number of jobs that were in the industry before consolidation and the number of jobs that are in the industry now. And I point out to them that had these things not occurred, had this consolidation, had these economy of scales not been applied, that there'd be more jobs for them to work in media. I've seen people, 40, 50 year pros, just out the door on a whim on any particular day of the week. And, you know, that's a different environment. It really, really is.
Well, Christopher, I really appreciate you explaining this and keeping it at least on the front of mind of Radio Survivor readers and listeners. We look forward to your future essays and research.
All right. Thanks for having me, guys.
And that was Christopher Terry. He is a lecturer in journalism and media at the University of Wisconsin in Milwaukee. And if you'd like to read his original piece for Radio Survivor, celebrating that fourth anniversary of the FCC's media ownership rules being tossed back at them by the Third Circuit Court of Appeals, go to our show notes, go to radiosurvivor.com/podcast, and you can see a list of all the articles and references we've had in today's program. That's radiosurvivor.com/podcast. Now, Eric, a listener Kent Peterson got a hold of us because he had some follow-up. He had some comments about our show where we discussed HD radio.
That's right, Paul. You know, on the show, nearly after every segment so far that we've aired, we've been asking for listener feedback, and we mean it. And I'm so happy to report that it wasn't all just wind. It wasn't all just for show, because we received this sound file over email.
Hi, my name is Kent Peterson. I'm a radio devotee in Minneapolis, Minnesota. And when Paul was talking about the implementation of digital radio, immediately kind of my ears perked up.
Radio Survivor listener Kent really likes digital radio. And in his opinion, HD is all about giving listeners more choices that sound better. And he says that the Minneapolis-St. Paul region is overflowing with digital radio.
We're really fortunate that this is a top 20 broadcast market. So a number of the big box radio companies, Cumulus and iHeartMedia, formerly known as AM/FM, formerly known as Clear Channel, own the vast majority of the Twin Cities broadcast commercial stations. And we've also got the giant public broadcaster here at Minnesota Public Radio that owns three full-power Class C1 100 kilowatt FM stations in this market. So here in the Twin Cities, we're lucky because we've got a news and information channel that Minnesota Public Radio has that's all news on their standard 91.1, which is called HD1. Then they run sort of a bluegrassy sort of a service that they call Radio Heartland. That runs on HD2. Sounds surprisingly good. Stereo, good fidelity. And then a really narrow bandwidth, a little bit of digital raspiness on HD3, and it's BBC World Service. So 24/7, I've got BBC World Service available to me just by a touch of my car radio preset or on my home radio as well, which I really love. They've also got a multicast that runs on The Current, which is KCMP, and on their HD1, it's just the standard Current, and on their HD2, it's something called Wonderground Radio, which is kind of a kid's channel. And then over on KSJN, their classical FM, on their HD1, it's just their standard repeat of their analog service. And their HD2, it's an instrumental only, which I love because it never features any opera programming. It is strictly just classical instrumentals. There's a smaller station up to the northwest of the Twin Cities metro area, but still comes in fine here. Call sign is KLCI-FM, and they run a four-channel mux. They've got country on their HD1. They run an ethnic Spanish on HD2. They've got a Southeast Asian programming of some kind on HD3, not exactly sure of the language. And then on HD4 is a really fun, kicking, it's a mono, 60s oldies on their HD4. So again, you're saving a little bit of bandwidth by being able to run the oldies on this HD4, and it actually sounds pretty good. I can put on the headphones. If you squint a little bit, and you'll hear a little bit of digital artifacting going on, but it's very listenable again.
Kent listed more digital radio channels, including but not limited to the HD stations that iHeartMedia, formerly Clear Channel, runs in his city, one which plays rhythm and blues, and another that is a gay dance station called Pride Radio. And there's more to choose from, Kent told us. He also says that he thinks digital radio should be the future.
Some people will say that AM radio or FM radio has worked perfectly good for the last 40, 50, 60, 80 years. Why change it now? Well, kind of the world's gone digital. And I used to be one of those who said that radio really didn't need to get fixed. I think it does. With the competition that's out there today, the internet, the streaming, the Pandoras, the live streaming services that are available on your smartphone, radio has to adapt. And I think one of the ways that radio has to adapt is it supplies us with more streams of information. One thing that I think has really let us down with iBox radio is how poorly the broadcasters have promoted these second and third streaming channels. Nobody knows about them. Yet everybody knows about Pandora. Everybody knows about XM Sirius. So to some degree, I think the broadcasters have set themselves up to fail. And how tragic, really how tragic, because radio is free. The radio comes off of that big tall tower down at the end of the block or the out in the cornfield, and it comes right through your walls. It comes into all of our homes. You don't have to pay a monthly subscription for it. It's just there.
So Kent Peterson is a real fan of digital radio, and he'd like to see it grow.
The broadcasters have to get off the stick. The car manufacturers have to start putting digital radios absolutely in every vehicle. But unfortunately for people at home, nobody's going to go out and buy a table radio or a clock radio anymore. They're going to have a little dock that they can stick their iPhone in, and in the morning it will play them the specific MP3s that they want to wake up to. And only a handful of us are going to end up getting that live original radio programming that we've grown accustomed to. But, you know, frankly, we're probably the old fuddy-duddies down at the end of the block.
So that's the excerpted version of a commentary on digital radio sent in by Kent Peterson, a listener to Radio Survivor. He's a passionate person regarding the world of radio, and chances are you are too. So if you're listening, and when the spirit moves you, send your thoughts to us on any topic we've discussed on the program.
Yeah, thank you for sharing your thoughts on that, Kent. You know, and Eric, actually, I mean, substantially in a lot of ways, I agree with him. I own an HD radio, and I do often tune in some of the interesting HD2 and HD3 channels. Oregon Public Broadcasting here in Portland has a music channel called OPB Music that's on their HD2, and it's pretty good. It's a pretty much kind of an alternative music format, not unlike KEXP out of Seattle.
Right, doing local stuff, I think.
They do a fair amount of local music. And I think it's pretty well done. I think most of their listenership is on the web. I like to listen to that. And there's several other great channels, or at least interesting channels, even on some of the commercial stations. My principal objection with HD radio is more about the technology rather than giving people more channels. It's about the fact that it's sort of a uneasy compromise by cramming it into the FM band. And therefore, which means it broadcasts at much lower power, is harder to receive. And I agree with Kent, then the broadcast industry has done a poor job of really advertising what the potential benefits of HD radio are, therefore failing to stimulate any interest in buying HD receivers. I think I'd be much more in favor of the European style digital broadcasting, where they picked a new set of spectrum, a new standard, and made the quality better, and also did a better job of advertising to listeners what the advantages are.
So if people are interested in hearing all 10 minutes of Kent Peterson's commentary, they can check it out on the show notes page. Right? We're going to post the whole thing in audio format on Radio Survivor's website.
Yes, absolutely. And now it's time for Lasar's Radio Letter.
This is Lasar's letter on radio for the Radio Survivor podcast. I'm Matthew Lasar. Today I want to talk about a big subject: community radio in Southern Africa and Eastern Africa and India. And that is a lot to talk about. These are huge, important places. But I'm not going to tell you quaint stories about lovely community radio stations or this or that village somewhere. This discussion is about how many of these countries are having serious debates about whether they want to have community radio stations at all. And I think we can learn something from those discussions. So here's a newspaper item from Botswana. Botswana is just above South Africa. It's just below Zambia. Botswana's advisory panel to its parliament has just called for the government to create a community radio network. And one advisor complained that many people can't participate in Radio Botswana, Botswana State Radio. It's spoken in Setswana. You can actually listen to it and tune in. Just check tune in for Radio Botswana 1 or 2. In any event, lots of people can't participate in it because the presenters don't understand their regional languages. So you may ask, why haven't community radio stations been set up yet? And interestingly and tellingly, another official in this newspaper article from which I'm quoting told a reporter, and I quote, "In the past, there have been fears of division and tribalism whenever community radio stations were mentioned." End of quote. And this is a big question for planners in Botswana or Zambia or similar places around southern Central Africa. Should the country deploy media to spur national unity or to empower localities? And I posted this discussion taking place in Botswana on Radio Survivor, and we got a response from a reader from Botswana, and I quote, "The manufacturing of a tribalistic idol is bound to cost everybody in government in maintenance costs. It will derail and frustrate government efforts of unifying the republic. Having a tribal identity will give reason and excuse to discriminate. One thing we know is that tribal consciousness will not help the economy, neither will it improve the lives of Botswana, and can introduce unintended friction. That's from a radio survivor reader. This is a discussion that is happening all around Southern Africa, Eastern Africa, and India. It's happening in Zambia, where the government just declared that it just doesn't have the money to help community radio. All the public money will go to national media sources, Zambia's top media regulator recently said. Why do I mention India? Well, first of all, many Indians live in East Africa. Many live in the great Kenyan city of Nairobi, which is a huge radio town and is definitely on my bucket list to visit. Forget Paris. I really want to go to Nairobi. Several years ago, a young Indian woman presenter in Nairobi, radio presenter in Nairobi, was brutally murdered by Al-Shabaab, the Al-Shabaab terrorist group. It was horrible. Thousands of people went to her funeral. So beloved was her radio programming. India itself is now having a big debate about community radio. Despite the fact that the country has over a billion people, it has less than 200 community radio stations, and India restricts what they can broadcast. Pete Tridish, who I'm guessing many of you Radio Survivor readers know as the founder of the Prometheus Radio Project, has an interesting blog post in the International Media Action blog. And he says that in India, which he's visited, there are fears that community radio stations could stoke communal violence. And Tridish writes, and I quote, "Enthusiasm for freedom of speech is tempered by concern about massacres, such as the fundamentalist Hindu attack on Muslims in Gujarat in 2002. Some worry that while most community stations would do good work, if they are not held to strict standards, they could be used as a tool to incite hate and riots against other groups. In the U.S., we consider hate speech the price of free speech, but it is important to remember that this is a fairly unusual attitude in the world. Most governments around the world regulate hate speech in some form." That's a quote from Pete Tridish of the Prometheus Radio Project. There's a lot of thought around the world going into the question of community radio and how it should be envisioned. And these concerns should extend to the United States, I think, where too many community radio stations have historically seen themselves as serving niche audiences rather than functioning as social vehicles for bringing people together. That's a conversation they're having in Africa and India, and maybe we should have it here too. And that's enough for one podcast post. This is Matthew Lasar with Lasar's Letter on Radio for the Radio Survivor podcast. Next time I'll tell you the best story about radio I've ever heard. Hint, it involves a famous Renaissance painting and a radio contest. Thank you for listening to me and for considering my words.
Thank you, Matthew, for that commentary. To me, it sounds like a good pitch for an hour-length documentary on what's going on there. At least an hour for each, an hour for Africa and an hour East Africa and an hour for India.
Absolutely.
That'll scratch the surface.
I would love nothing but to send you, Eric.
No, I can't possibly go. But thank you, Paul.
You can.
I'll hire the freelancer. I think I actually know a few from my FSRN days. Maybe this is more than a pipe dream if we
absolutely
we'll send an email.
It really is. In fact, it's that sort of thing which, you know, I don't want to plug our Patreon, but I'm going to have to, that we've put into our Patreon campaign to really ask people to help us do this sort of work to document, you know, this side of community media. We'd love to do even more coverage of that. It just is tough to do from my home office here in Portland without the ability to, I don't know, board a plane or find freelancers who would be willing to do this work and to pay them a fair wage to do that work, which I think is something very important for all of us to want to do. So, you know, take a look. Maybe you want to help support those kind of goals. Go to patreon.com/radiosurvivor. And with that, I think we can put this show in the can.
Dense, information rich.
Indeed. And I say put it in the can, and I wonder if people even know what that reference is. Worry that they think we want to flush it down the toilet.
In the can, along with the ice box and the pocketbook.
Oh, indeed. Yes, the can of tape is what that would have been, like a can of film.
We taped a very nice show today.
I think we did, all without any tape being harmed in the process of creating this show. So, hey, go to radiosurvivor.com to read much more about all of the stories we've discussed here today. And, hey, give us a rating. Give us some stars on iTunes. We'd love that. We'd really appreciate it. And look at the reviews that are there. You can actually mark if they're helpful or not. And there are several helpful reviews. So go ahead and give those reviewers a little kudo and click, was this review helpful? Say yes. We really appreciate that too. And of course, our email is podcast@radiosurvivor.com.
Thanks, everybody.